Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast, where editors of Managed Healthcare Executive chat with healthcare executives in the C-Suite and professionals. Our conversations are about the most important issues facing American healthcare today, such as its cost, effectiveness, delivery, organization, and its fairness. Listen in, learn a lot. Hi there, I'm Brianna Contreras, and I'm Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. In this week's episode, I had the pleasure of meeting Kevin Rusavsky, CEO of Quanterix, a blood-based biomarker analysis company. Rusavsky is also the founder of Powering Precision Health. In this discussion, I was able to learn more about Powering Precision Health, as it is Rusavsky's initiative to improve precision health for patients and some tools like the Disruptive Innovation 5-Step Model that brings his vision closer of detecting and improving the health of patients sooner. Hi, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Great, Brianna. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thank you for joining me for an episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast.
My pleasure. Excited for it.
Well, for the first question, can you just inform myself and listeners and readers of Managed Healthcare Executive about your role and the mission of Quanterix?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm chairman CEO of Quanterix, and our mission basically is to take some disruptive technologies that we believe allow you to see non-invasively in blood and maybe saliva in some cases, disease before symptoms. And it's almost that simple. I've also been very involved in a movement called Powering Precision Health. It's a foundation. And I actually learned a lot about the importance of seeing disease extremely early before symptoms and the role that that can play in both getting therapies discovered that are really important, but also for preventing disease by seeing the disease cascade so early that you can actually, sometimes we think longer term, change your lifestyle to maybe prevent the continued disease triggers that might be causing the disease in the first place. So we're pretty excited about this, this approach of being able to see disease before symptoms, and the technologies of Quanterix enable this better than anything we could see in the world.
Wonderful. Thank you. And throughout the conversation, we'll definitely dig more into, you know, the topic of precision health. So actually within my next question, can you explain more about your precision health mission and what that means to you?
Yeah, you know, it's something we've been attacking for like 25 years. And originally we called it precision medicine. Mm-hmm. And then we realized that, you know, precision medicine feels more like, once you have a disease, what's the best, most precise medicine to treat the disease? And we felt that that was too limiting to the possibilities of what a non-invasive early detection biomarker could do for you. Because we actually think if you can use these really early in the disease cascade, or even in the way you live your life, and understand how you might be damaging or creating disease triggers in the way that you live your life, whether it's smoking or obesity or addiction to sugars, like so many things that can, we think, be the basis of disease. We didn't want to limit precision medicine to that. So that's why we renamed it precision health, because in the long term, we think that the journey is something that we'd like for each person to be able to have the technologies and the information to empower themselves to have their own health journey. And that's a lot of the quest of the precision health movement.
Great, thank you. Now to kind of go on the other end of precision health, can you share possibly what precision health is currently lacking for patients with, you know, their uniquely unmet needs?
Yeah, so I would say that that's what led us, a group of us, to kind of lead the precision health and figure out what technologies from where we sat have the greatest potential to impact precision health. And that then is what's missing. And For us, the ability to see disease early, non-invasively, is critical. It's like today, a biopsy, by the time you have a billion cancer cells agglomerated in a tumor, it might be way too late. Many times you don't get symptoms of certain types of cancers like pancreatic until it's stage four and already pretty lethal for the body. And so same with Alzheimer's. By the time you get dementia, the pathology is so advanced, and some evidence would suggest it's advanced by as much as 15 years. And so that is the kind of conceptual approach that said, if we can get into companies that have technologies that can unearth the ability to achieve that killer app that precision health needs, then we should use our, energy to do that. And that's where Quanterix, 908 Devices, there's several companies I'm involved in now that are looking at the protein, which we think is a much more important biomarker than much of what we've been spending a lot of time with over the last, let's say, 50 years, which is imaging, X-rays, CAT scans, PET scans, as well as a lot of different types of biopsies, things that are being used today to measure disease, a spinal tap. We think they're very invasive and late. And so some of these opportunities, when you look at the protein, that's when the disease actually kicks in. It starts to elevate. And much of the DNA and RNA is more like the recipes that may or may not trigger into the actual disease cascade. So that's more about predisposition. But the protein, we think, has got this incredible capability. And so when you apply DNA level of sensitivity to the protein, it gives you this unique ability to look in the body and see how your body is navigating all of the disease triggers, and probably more importantly, tell you pretty quickly when those proteins start to elevate that the disease cascade is actually triggered and started. So if you can see that long before the symptom, you might have a much better chance of arresting the disease. And we've seen that across heart health as well as oncology. If you can find the heart disease long before the event of a heart attack, or see the cancers long before they present as a tumor, you have a better chance of treating. And we think the same is absolutely true in Alzheimer's. There's a lot of evidence in some of the recent drug trial work from Biogen and Lilly and Roche that suggests that the earlier you see the disease, the better chance the drug is going to have of arresting the disease. And so that's why we want to approach a lot of the initial focus on drug companies, letting them use this technology to recruit patients long before symptoms to see if these drugs that maybe didn't work in the past can work if you can use them really early. And that's become a kind of a revolutionary approach to the drug development process. But once those drugs are approved, then we think a lot of the focus should be on seeing these diseases early in your annual physicals, long before any kind of symptom, and then have the drugs and a menu of them that can, arrest whatever early pathology you might have for one of the lethal diseases.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. And not to really put a number on it, because it's probably hard to put a number on certain diseases, but if you could say, if it is possible to say, I guess how early can you detect some of these things through this new way of finding a disease?
Yeah, I think the best way for us right now, and it is like an iceberg where we only can see the top of the iceberg. When you go underneath the water, there's still a lot of unknowns that we're all trying to navigate. But the more sensitivity we bring to it, the more the waterline drops, and we can start to see more of that iceberg. And I think that we've got the beginnings of some evidence that when you look at baselines, that's the level of the protein in blood when you're healthy. We call that the baseline healthy level. And typically, proteins elevate when you get sick. And so, in the case of Alzheimer's, there's been some, there's certain types of hereditary Alzheimer's that they know a person has it based on the recipes, the genes. And they can almost predict when it is that that person should get Alzheimer's. They call that familial Alzheimer's. And so there was a trial run where they took a lot of those patients, and they knew when Alzheimer's was going to hit, and they decided to then look at some of the brain biomarkers in blood using our technology. to see when is it on that cascade of life that those biomarkers began to elevate from baseline levels. And two biomarkers of interest, neurofilament light, NFL, which was really uncovered initially for concussions with the NFL, the National Football League, and General Electric. So it's a kind of a coincidence that, you know, the NFL and the NFL have that correlation. But that's one biomarker. Another one is phosphorylated tau 217. Both of these biomarkers in these familial Alzheimer trials showed evidence that they started to elevate as much as 15 years before dementia. So that is like remarkable. And, you know, on average, that's such a breakthrough because people, you know, don't have any symptoms, might be in the disease cascade. Then they start to get mild cognitive impairment, and then they go into extreme cognitive impairment. And a lot of the current drug trials are using biomarkers to try to get cohorts of patients that are in the mild cognitive impairment or really early, because again, there's evidence that by doing so, they'll have a better chance of stopping the progression of the disease with chemistries that sometimes can be toxic to the body. And so you actually want to get the disease as early as possible so you don't have to put as much of a dose of whatever medicine it is in the body either. So in a way, both efficacy and toxicity can both be improved with this technique of applying this technology early to those cascades. And again, 15 years, I don't think there's any drug trials on people that have that really early stage, but you know, someday I think that's the promise of the technology.
Yeah, that's very impressive. Now we'll kind of, this is a bit, maybe a bit repetitive, but if you can share possibly what tools that you've adapted to meet this mission of precision health of yours. So for example, I believe it was mentioned you use a disruptive innovation 5-step model.
Yeah, so it's interesting. When we look at advancing a pioneering technology in the truest sense, the technology being the electromechanical thing that is the technology that you're trying to commercialize, we also think that a lot of what goes into that is the way in which you interact with that technology. And what we have found over the years is that there's some rules that we call the disruptive innovation 5 steps to commercialize a disruptive technology, basically. And those 5 steps is start with a greater purpose, get everyone fired up to do something big with the technology that you're trying to commercialize, like take down Alzheimer's, take down cancer, something that everyone can get behind and be inspired by it and motivated. Number two then is build what we call an ecosystem of all the constituencies that play a role in any kind of a technology being commercialized. And that would include the scientists, it would include the innovators, it would include the employees of the technology companies, it would include the investors, the people that are trying to fund it. And it would include like the agencies like the FDA, the NIH. It would include the payer groups, the people like United Health Group that are charged with trying to improve the health of their membership by improving the cost effectiveness of outcome management. So the way they deploy and provide medical practices, they try to do it efficiently, right? So all those kinds of individuals and groups are what we call constituencies. And when we put them all in a room together and we ask them all to work together towards the greater purpose, it allows collaboration and breakthroughs to occur where you're connecting dots much faster. So that's number two, is to build that ecosystem. In this case, it's called Powering Precision Health, a nonprofit foundation. Number three then would be the culture. And the things we've landed on culture is AT&T squared. Accountability, teamwork, trust, the speed of trust, and transparency. If you really apply AT&T squared in the culture of a company or in the culture of the ecosystem, and you're truly being transparent with the information and you're not competing with each other and you're really working as a team and you really can trust that you're going after that greater purpose and not trying to create profitability maybe as a subset, but you're really trying to go after and do something good for the world, we found that that AT&T really leads to breakthroughs. And then number four is to have a strategic roadmap where you think about the investments that you're going to make either in R&D in the company or in sales and marketing, finance, HR in the company, or inorganically, which means you might acquire companies in order to bring them together because 1 + 1 = 3. We call that our strategic roadmap. That's number four, is to lay that out. Number five is kind of interesting. It's superb execution, but it's how do you interact with the ecosystem or the employees? With AT&T squared means transparency. So many times we call it high contact speed leading, where you go into a meeting not knowing what the elephant in the room is, and you ask to figure out from those that come into the room with different experiences from around the ecosystem, you know, what is it that's blocking us from our progress? And when you learn, sometimes we'll change the agenda of a 2 days worth of meetings that follow just based on what someone brings into that meeting. We call that real-time leadership, where you're really trying to pull onto the table the thing that most places and most companies might actually not talk about because they don't know the answer to it, and it would be uncomfortable, and they might want to avoid that because it creates disruption. We actually are like the opposite. If we can find a failure, we can learn from it and progress. But if people are unwilling to fail, we'll never progress. And so when you're disrupting that number five, that the way you interact with all of the ecosystem and the speed leading, we call it, and the executing really requires that transparency, the trust that you're going to not get killed if you provide something that you failed, which is accountability. You start with yourself, say, hey, I failed, before you point the finger at everyone else. Create a radical blamectomy in the culture of the company with that fifth item. So we use those five steps in everything we do to try to figure out faster how to get these technologies commercialized. And we've now created these collaborations with major pharma customers, and we use those same principles. We call them DiFi collaborations, where we're trying to accelerate the pace of the breakthroughs between the two companies. And so it's pretty important to how to advance, we think, commercialization. And again, we learn a lot of things that are failures, and that's the hardest part, is to have the courage to dust off and jump up and stay inspired when you're failing. And unfortunately, when you're pioneering and trying to take down cancer or Alzheimer's, you're probably going to fail 99% of the time. So how do you create a mechanism that you actually get inspired by your failures is a lot of what, you know, we do. It's a little bit upside down, but in disruption, you have to kind of be willing to go at it that way, we think.
Yeah, it seems like a really good model to follow, I feel. And it seems like it's doing a good job.
Thank
So
you.
for my next question, can you share how COVID-19 sparked a shift toward precision health treatment and prevention?
Yeah, you know, so many things to say about this one. Maybe starting with some of our customers, some of our largest customers in Quanterix, companies like Eli Lilly, they all played a frontline role in COVID. So many of them opened up laboratories to try to help with testing, and they would try to get antibodies that could help fight the COVID. So many of our customers got into it, which caused them to change the whole mindset and the speed of going after some type of solution. Moderna, J&J, Pfizer for the vaccines, more customers that they try to do things in like 1 year or a half a year that normally takes 7 years. And so amid all the rules were needing to be broken, and then you had the FDA working with these companies to do what's called emergency use authorizations. And so we could see all that happening with our customers, but we also wanted to keep our employees safe. And so all of our practices had to change, and half our people end up working from home. And so there was a lot of trauma put into the system initially, because working from home for many people created new challenges and new things that they didn't expect. Or if you worked in the facility, how do you make sure you don't get COVID and just transporting and then working in the? So we had to put all those practices in place. Then we pivoted towards trying to use our technologies to see COVID before symptoms, because that's when COVID was actually most contagious. Is the 24 hours before symptoms. It's the first virus that actually spread before the symptoms. Normally, it was a coughing and a sneezing that created the spread. This disease was, and virus is different. So our technology that could see disease before symptoms became paramount. So the NIH gave us 20 million. They asked us to kind of build out testing. And now we got two EUAs, one for serology and semi-quantitation, being able to measure all those antibodies in the blood. And then we also can measure the virus in the blood. We can measure it in saliva. We got the first antigen test for saliva. We can also, we get an asymptomatic, which means they gave us a ruling that you could use this test when you don't have symptoms, and it's going to give you an answer that's good versus so many false positives and false negatives out there in this. So, the Delta virus is another thing. We were the first in antigen to have that variant being able to be measured by our technology. So the speed of doing all that, we had some of the greatest employees in the world that led through that. They didn't take weekends off. They just worked around the clock. And that caused us all to Zoom. The Zoom culture got created, and the speed of evolution and innovation got accelerated. And here we are now on the tailwind, we hope, of COVID. And those practices that occurred because of COVID are still in place. And so we're now honing in on Alzheimer's with some of our testing, and we're trying to approach it with the same speed of clarity that we had with COVID. And even home sampling is becoming another trend because people don't want to go to a lab and risk exposure. So the whole concept of getting the less invasive sampling also plays into the kind of technology that we have. Less invasive, and seeing it earlier, requires exquisite sensitivity of measuring proteins. And that's what Quanterix technology does. It's incredibly sensitive.
Great, thank you.
No
Lastly,
problem.
I wanted to know what you saw in the future of precision health.
Yeah, I think the future of precision health, from my perspective, has probably been said a little bit earlier that I think this concept of being able to measure the biomarkers during your annual visit will be probably the next step. So you see what might be going on early. But if you can someday have a biomarker watch where you literally are kind of seeing if I'm drinking a glass of wine or if I'm having a cigarette or if I'm jogging or if I'm, eating broccoli versus eating red meat, can I see what it's doing to my biomarkers more on a real-time basis? It's a dream, I know, but I actually think that that is ultimately how someday you might be able to use technology instead of a Fitbit. It'd be more like a Fitbit on steroids that was actually teaching you all about the inner workings and the chemistries of the proteins and maybe the DNA and RNA as well in your body real-time so that you can navigate your own health journey and try to prevent the disease triggers, because we think most of disease is based on the way the human conducts their life as opposed to what they're born with. There's been a lot of evidence in breast cancers and many of the cancers from MD Anderson, many studies saying that 80% of what's creating the disease isn't the genes you're born with. It's more about how you're living your life. And so those epigenetic factors, we think someday, if you can quantitate that and consumerize it in a way for people, that would really be a cool way to try to avoid people having early deaths, particularly the young, by seeing these things very early and doing something about it.
Yeah, that definitely would be an amazing, very innovative thing for the future. Well, yeah, that's actually, again, all I had for you. But if there's anything else, Kevin, that you'd like to add that maybe we didn't touch on in this conversation?
Well, hey, I'm like now in that last generation, and so there's a lot of new generation that's kind of coming into these sciences, and I just think it is a really important moment to keep the pressure on, particularly as we look at new avenues with the immunotherapies and a lot of the newer drug regimens for cancers, and the way we have been successful seeing cardio health long before the event of a heart attack. Same thing now, hopefully, with a lot of the neuro diseases. And you have a lot of opioid addiction that's going on, a lot of comorbidity around post-traumatic stress disorder, so much mental health challenge that's occurring. Now we're even hearing that maybe Google and Facebook and others are creating addictions with the way they are creating their programs and further maybe pushing into damaging neuro health. So our view is that this is a pretty important moment to let the science and the advances of COVID apply to really good areas that could eliminate profitability particularly for those businesses that are triggering disease. And we think there's a lot of businesses that actually are triggering disease because they're making money off of us. The food industry, particularly, there's a lot of evidence of a lot of obesity and a lot of, you know, sugar addictions and, you know, just things going on with the nutrition of what we eat could itself be a, you know, a key factor. And the pesticides being used in the food industry and all the growth hormones and the linkages to cancers and breast cancer. There's so much evidence that we see that this is a moment that we could say, hey, if you're going to have a business, let's make sure that while it doesn't create a carbon footprint, let's also make sure that it doesn't destroy and destruct the human. And I think that there's greater and greater technology opportunity to advance that opportunity. So thanks for doing this. Brianna, this is a great way to discuss it and to create some energy for the opportunity.
Oh, of course, Kevin. Thank you for, you know, the time and for, again, you know, not only educating me, but a lot of our readers and listeners. So yeah, thank you.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.